Morning, everybody. Hey. Guten Morgen. That's the end of the German for my presentation. I'm delighted to be here, delighted to be able to speak English. Thank you to the translators, and thank you very much for the invitation, especially to Sylvia, who I met at a conference organised in Cambridge in September last year, 2016, marking 100 years of democracy and education by John Dewey. And in my presentation today, I want to talk about democracy. I want to have us think about democracy because I would suggest we have a bit of a problem with democracy. In my own country, we had a plebiscite recently, a referendum. Well, you know the story. This is repeatedly talked about as democracy, that we should defend this as a democratic act. We should listen to the people's voices. So John Dewey reminded us that democracy was something that had to be worked on continually, every day, and every generation had to redefine and remake, literally remake democracy. And he located the engine room for the remaking of democracy in the modern school. So I want to plant that in your mind when we think about the things that I'm going to talk about. So I want to talk about democracy and education and what we might mean by that today. I want to talk about the view of the child or the view of the young person in two ways, both the view of the young person about education, about the world, and also the view we have of young people. Literally, the image we hold in our heads of young people and children, and how visual literacy and critical visual literacy is very important today as we try to strengthen our sense of democracy. And finally, I thought I'd be a bit provocative and talk about borderlands, the edges of things, what we find at the outside edge of the thing that we're interested in, because I suggest to you that there we might find the most interesting things happening. I want to talk about how democracy was viewed at the end of the Second World War, when fascism had been defeated for the moment, always ready to rise again at any point, and where across Europe and America, the Western, the Allies, sought to strengthen the resistance to future fascism through schooling. So why look back to imagine the future? What are the consistencies in education that emerge over time and that are particularly relevant today? What can the new emphasis on the views of children and their participation in design bring to the relationship between past, present, and future in designing for education? The post-war consensus that I'm referring to was towards the pursuit of knowledge in the fuller sense of the word and a view of the child as an artist rather than a technician. I think that's a really interesting idea, the view of the child as an artist, a maker of meaning, rather than a technician, somebody who just repeats and learns like a machine. And a maker of meaning, an inventor, an experimenter, a dreamer. Characteristics and trends in primary education that architects and educators in my own country and their colleagues, first in the regions of England, in Hertfordshire, Oxfordshire, Leicestershire, and at the heart of government in the Ministry of Education, where architects and educators collaborated together in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. They talked about principles of design, principles of designing for education. And they've looked very carefully at childhood and children, and they thought very deeply about democracy. And they talked about infinite variety in children, in ways of learning, and in materials used. And they wanted to reflect that idea of infinite variety in the design of educational environments. They talked about the natural energy and exuberance of children. They wanted to recognize that and allow for it. They talked about confidence and friendliness in school-based relationships, an atmosphere of friendly informality in lessons. They talked about blurring the divisions between adult and child, age groups of learners, parts of the school day, the inside and outside, and between subjects in the curriculum. And they wanted a pedagogy that allowed children to take elements of their learning from start to finish without interruption. Quote, to seize the opportunity and catch the moment. All these ideas, all these principles, I've become fascinated by, not because they're interesting in themselves, but of course they are, but because they connect so strongly with children's ideas about education for the future that I talked about yesterday, expressed in the School I'd Like competition in the UK and repeated in Australia. And there's a competition, an initiative in Belgium at the moment that you should know about, where children are expressing their ideas about schools for the future. And there's going to be one here. There are consistencies here with the ideas for strengthening democracy through redesigning education, redesigning the relationships of education, including school buildings, but not just about school buildings. There's consistency between ideas of children today about the future and these ideas from the past. The idea was to see how far it was possible through the opportunities of national school building renewal to, without discouraging teachers who preferred traditional methods, encourage those teachers who were exploring approaches that more fully utilised space and equipment. The new schools designed in this period were light, airy, modern, and economical. They look rather drab from the outside, but on the inside they were intricately designed, where moving from place to place was imagined to be a pleasant experience, where no two learning spaces looked the same, and there was a range and variety of spaces provided to reflect as far as possible the range and variety in children. I'm quoting from the Chief Inspector for Primary Education, Louis Christian Schiller. So these schools were designed for younger children, what we call primary education. The same ideas were there for secondary education, but for reasons I will talk about later, probably, it was always much more difficult to challenge the design of secondary education. These schools were designed to permit deep and lasting first-hand experience. Somebody mentioned head, heart, and hand yesterday. This was a very strong idea at the time. The schools should be open, but not entirely open. There were to be opt-out spaces provided where children could be quiet if they wanted to be, withdrawal spaces, where the views out of the school were as pleasurable as possible. And storage was integrated into furnishings and fittings to cater for the capacities of children and their teachers. These were to be uncluttered environments where children were comfortable and could move easily from place to place, and where there was a continual flow of bodies from one activity to another, supported by a team of teachers working cooperatively. They were to be domestic and homely environments. Deinstitutionalization was a term used. That suggested certain kinds of decoration and comfort. Where children had their own workspace with materials to hand, where they had their own home bay, and home was a term that was used, with toilets and cloakrooms close by. Toilets are very important to children. And where all spaces were utilised as learning and teaching spaces, including halls, corridors, and outside areas, often covered with verandas. And finally, and this is still quoting from the Chief Inspector of Education, where living things flourished, including school pets, I'll say that again, school pets, plants, trees, and gardens. So these were going to be places full of life, where things needed to be nurtured and looked after. I want to just talk briefly about this school, Crow Island School, in Winnetka, which is north of Chicago in America. And Crow Island School became, it was a school I'd like. It was a school that the director of education there envisaged as an ideal school. He was Carlton Washburn, a really interesting man, a very progressive educator, a Quaker, a pacifist. And he had this school designed by the very best European architects of the time, collaborating with American architects. And he wrote a lot about this school. The school has just celebrated, I think, 80 years, no, what's 41, 75 years. It's still going strong. I visited there and they're very proud of the school building. It was picked up by the architectural press in 1941 very strongly. There's a lot been written about this school, but I just wanted to quote the first director of the school, Francis Presler, here. Because this quote has been picked up again and again by others who realised there was something very important being said here. So she was talking about a school, what a school should be in this period, during the war. It must be a place which permits the joy in the small things of life and in democratic living. It must be inspiring with a beauty that suggests action, not passiveness on children's part. It must be democratic. That, above all, is necessary. So, learning to live together. How can schools be designed that actually puts value high up on the list of things we're interested in learning to live together? Learning to use freedom. And learning to use freedom at this time required experience of making choices and making real decisions, not just on who to employ as a teacher, not simply in school council meetings and so on, but typically on what you learn, when you learn, and where you learn it, supported by the teacher. I've written a chapter for a book that's just come out about designing schools. I can't remember the title of the book, but I wrote a chapter about quiet spaces, because these spaces for quietness and withdrawal were seen to be crucial. Not just places where children could be sent to calm down, but places where children could choose to go, make a decision to go to when they needed to. So democracy in action meant really experiencing making choices that might lead to problems, failure, but experience, action, making choices. And I've talked about movement and bodies in flow. And movement was a key term at this time. Movement mattered within the school and beyond the school walls. Movement became a subject in the curriculum through the interesting influence of emigre artists such as Rudolf von Laban, the dance educator, who fled Europe and tried to get to America, but he spent some time in England. And he influenced a generation of teachers on expressive dance and movement. And so these schools, which were light, airy, full of movement and choice, were also full of semi-naked bodies in full expression and free flow. So the material environment really mattered. So you had to think very carefully about the wood that was used for school floors, so that dancing in bare feet would be a beautiful experience, a sensual experience. So movement within the school, free flow, choice, cooperation, openness, but infinite variety. Movement in the curriculum, but movement as an experience of using the local environment as a curriculum resource. And I can't say how fully the arts were recognised as important. I can't say how fully enough the arts were recognised as important. So education through art, to quote Herbert Reed, 1943, education through art, through the arts, was taken seriously and practised in many schools where architects were sent to look and see what was happening. I'm not talking about art happening in the art room or on the edge of the curriculum, but the whole curriculum being taught through the arts. And Sir Alec Clegg, I've been talking about my hero, my current hero at the moment, is Sir Alec Clegg, was a director of education for the West Riding of Yorkshire between 1945 and 1974. Very long time. So he was a local authority education director, not a teacher as such, but somebody who tried to promote a particular kind of progressive education at the heart of local government. And he was recognised as the most progressive, most respected progressive education administrator in the 20th century. Practically unheard of, practically forgotten, but I'm trying to bring his ideas back. And one of the things he said was, he talked about measuring things and assessing things. And he said, the things that are most easy to measure are the things that are less important. The things that are most difficult to measure in education are the things that should be valued most. Just a moment thinking about utopianism and consistency of hope. I think when we take a historical or long view, we recognise that there are consistencies over time. Things keep recurring. And the idea that the school might change, explode, reconfigure, where the arts would take arts and expression would take a central place rather than be pushed to the edge. These are consistent ideas, and I reckon that they will emerge in the School I'd Like competition or initiative in Germany. So utopianism in education is a consistency. John Dewey said, the most utopian thing about utopia is there are no schools. Think about it. I set that as an exam question once in Cambridge just to find out what the answer is. I'm still thinking about that. Here's some utopian thinking. The schools themselves will move closer to the world. The school building will become a base from which children operate, rather than a place in which they are isolated for a fixed number of hours each day. Much of the teacher's work will be to plan and interpret. This is great. The interpenetration of school and neighbourhood will be promoted by buildings in which design will become ever more open. The classroom box will disappear. The school building will come to be thought of as a social centre. The main spaces will be very varied, so that to pass from one to another will be a pleasing experience in itself. You can hear echoes in this statement from what I've just been talking about. The problem here is that that was said about quite confidently about by the year 2000. And it was written, it's a text from an inspector of schools, HMI, Ken Leyburn, December 1960. So he was sitting in his room in 1960, imagining school in the year 2000, when the classroom box will disappear, and all the rest of it. So we could get depressed. We could get down about these sorts of things, but I prefer to recognise that these ideas are the most valuable ideas, the strongest ideas, because they're the ideas that keep recurring, keep turning up. And we have a chance now to link them strongly with the ideas of children and young people, if we are to take their ideas seriously, rather than compartmentalise them. So into this atmosphere came Colin Ward. I've been asked to talk a little bit about Colin Ward, who was a teacher. He became an anarchist during the Second World War. I mean, something like a world war would turn anybody into an anarchist, don't you think? He became an anarchist who wrote about everything. He wrote a wonderful book called The Child and the City, The Child in the City, in 1973, 75, I think it was. He wrote The Child in the Country as well. He used photography. He was very interested in images that we make of children and how that makes us think about children. He produced a book called Street Work, The Exploding School. I have a copy here if anybody wants to have a look at it. You can probably get it on Amazon for a penny and then pay for the postage. It's wonderful, wonderful book. This happens to be Sir Alec Clegg's personal copy. So this, you know, my excitement and thrill is overflowing, because my two heroes, I do write about women as well. I've written a book about Mary Medd, the architect, but these happen to be men. My two heroes come together because in the book, Alec Clegg has scribbled on it. Underlined things, made notes. This is exciting. Wonderful. It's wonderful stuff. Anyway, what was this all about? Street Work, The Exploding School, was an idea of how children might be educated differently using the urban environment. And Colin Ward, with his colleague Tony Fison, worked for the Town and Country Planning Organisation. Sounds very conservative, the Town and Country Planning Organisation. And they got jobs as education officers in the 1970s. And so what they did was they produced a bulletin of environmental education for a decade, just over a decade. So these were sent out to schools that subscribed to the bulletin. And the bulletins are all available. They're all in my office, taking up a lot of space. I'm waiting for somebody to come and work on them. A PhD, maybe? And I can't go into full detail of what they contain. They are remarkable documents of action and hope. Colin Ward's idea was, just as education through art envisaged education being realised through art, he believed that education could be realised through urban experience, urban pedagogy. But Unfortunately, his vision, his utopian vision, was lessened, really. It was geography teachers who tended to take this up, not so much the maths teachers, the English teachers, the physics teachers, although he tried to suggest that environmental education could be a cross-curriculum activity. What's quite interesting is the view of the child that's presented in these bulletins, the image of children in risky sorts of situations. Colin Ward recognised quite fully how teachers were constrained to take children out into the physical environment, but nevertheless, he was the sort of gentle anarchist who kept plodding away and kept writing anyway. I've just pulled out a few that fascinate me, and that is where children are using cameras, making records of visual records of their world. But you get issues like this, which depict children in unlikely situations for school teachers to find palatable. So, yes, all very practical ideas embedded in these issues. So I'm going to come to an end. So Colin Ward's work envisaged working on the borders between school and community. John Dewey recognised the borders between school and community as vital for any kind of regeneration of democracy. I think borderlands are important for us today. Working on the fringes of ideas, working on the fringes of physical environments. And I would suggest the most radical changes in education are more likely to be made in the borderlands between school and community. And democratic nurturing is vital for the schools of today and tomorrow. And so I leave it with you. How can we make it an ultimate value to recognise that democracy, and whatever we mean by that, somebody said it was a myth yesterday. Maybe it is a myth. But if it's a myth, it's a myth that we can work with. And I'd argue very strongly that if we're to think about designing schools for the future, if we are to have a future, then we might need to replace our fascination with learning with our more strong fascination with democratic modes of living together. Thank you.